is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name's Ian Murphy. I'm here at MTPCon 26 with Todd Olson, CEO of Pendo. Todd, hi.
How you doing, Ian? Good to be here.
I'm okay. Do you want to give us the 30-second elevator pitch of you and Pendo?
Sure. Well, 30-second of me, it's probably a little longer than 30 seconds, but like, let me just give you Pendo. I created Pendo 13 years ago to address what I saw was happening in the industry. Too often we build software, we build technology that simply isn't adopted. Fast forward to today, we're building even more software, and shockingly, we're seeing challenges with adoption. So Pendo, our company mission is focusing on driving adoption of software through making sure that users are getting value out of it. And that's through a lot of metrics and working closely with them.
I've got 44 plus years in this industry dealing with software companies, and watching the whole software lifecycle management chain evolve and change.
Yeah, hasn't it?
The big problem at the moment is, how do we make software that people want? Because people are overloaded with choice. They never quite get what they want out of one product. They end up with two, three, four things in their company. What is failing us in the software business in developing proper products that meet need?
I think all too often, people don't focus enough on what is the core job to be done and pain that we're solving. Very often, we naively think that we can just go ask a handful of users, hey, what do you want us to build? And they say, these are the three things we want to build, and we go build those things. And then we're shocked that the products like just don't take off. There's a great quote from, I think it's Jacob Nielsen, and that says something to the effect of, you know, asking people what they want or will they use it is like asking people to predict the future. And people are horrendously bad at predicting the future. They just are. The real mindset shift you have to go to is, how do we experiment quickly? How do we put real software in front of people and like watch them use it? And then how do we all be unafraid to take things away when they don't work? And that's actually one of the more interesting challenges. People are reluctant to remove things from technology and software when they clearly don't work. So then we end up with essentially clutter in these interfaces, which in general detract from the overall experience. That to me is part of the root cause. It's just mindset differences. And people hold on to things and they just will not get rid of it. And I think that leads to bad experience in general.
I've watched companies over the years evolve their products, tell partners what they can and can't do, deprecate features. But they often don't deprecate the features in their own versions. They tell partners to do it. And the excuse, Microsoft, very good example of this, is, oh, well, we've got customers who are still using a product that's 8 years old.
Always a good excuse.
We can't deprecate it. So how do we then take stuff out that isn't working? It becomes a stability issue.
One, I think analytics can really inform things. Very often people are flying blind to who's using. I've inherited software products over the years where I come and we got this thing. No developer likes working on it. It's clearly tech debt. Most customers are complaining about it. Why is it still there? Well, such and such customer is still using it. Well, have we called them and said, do you like it? Have we explored a workaround?
They're often just locked in, aren't they? They can't get out.
But I think it's often self-inflicted. People don't want to have the tough conversation with the customers like, we want to remove this. So because of that, people always find the happy path through these things. I'd rather have the hard conversations. We are going to remove this. Go tell the customer why it's bad for them. It's bad for us to maintain something that's old and crufty and doesn't quite work that well. Yes, we can keep it alive from you, but you're the only one we're keeping it alive from. And it's costing us a lot of money. And do you really want to be the only customer using this one thing? I find that people are not honest enough in general and avoid hard conversations. A lot of this human dynamic is the avoid hard conversations. It's easier to add.
But our biggest challenge, and you mentioned it just now, is that user interaction. People don't like being tracked. They don't like people seeing what bit they use and what bit they don't use. They think that's too intrusive.
Yeah.
We bring people into offices, we sit them in front of the software, and we run a focus group, and we say, play with it, let us see what you do. Here's a set of tasks, show us how you move around the screen. I remember doing RAD, Rapid Application Development, in the early 90s, where we sat with the user to understand, and we still knew nothing at the end of the day. So how do we improve a user interface that works for everybody? And I say this personally because I am so fed up with people taking away features I like or hiding them.
It's a combination of really good analytics on quantitative and qualitative data. One is watching what people actually do. How are people traversing through software? And it could be everything from watching trends and data to actually watching real screen captures. And that's one of the exciting things about technology today. You don't have to sit behind a double-sided mirror and watch someone use it. You can just essentially watch what people do. You had a couple things in your question around privacy and people don't, but I think as long as you're not using this against them, very often you'll see in terms of service, as long as we're using it to improve the service, it's okay. But people don't like it being sold to advertising to be used against you. And I think as long as we're using it for good, I think it's okay. Watching what people are doing, understanding where people are actually getting stuck, and then also combining that with good qualitative dating, asking people, how was this experience? What do you think? That will help. One of the interesting things we're seeing now with this whole generative AI movement is that if you're looking at these conversational interfaces, people are telling you what they want the software to do. And that's actually one of the most interesting trends I see today. We have a new product called Agent Analytics. It essentially grabs the conversations. And it's one of the best signals of intent that I've ever seen, because people just ask the software what they want it to do. And they're not necessarily told it can do this, but you start to understand what they expect out of the software. We're starting to do this work where we have themes that we're seeing through it, and then we're grading the quality of the software's handling of those themes. What's the retention rate? What's the frustration rate? Just overall trends, how often it is. But we have this concept of track themes, things we assume the agent is supposed to be good at, and then we have emergent themes, which is things that we had no idea that someone was trying to use this thing for, but they clearly are trying to use it, and you should start paying attention to it. Those are the kind of signals that I think are incredibly valuable today where people are building software, is that people just tell you now. You don't have to guess. And maybe that's a positive byproduct of all this AI movement. We have some of the best data ever now on what people expect out of software.
Now, you're using your own AI for this, Leo.
Yes.
But if you're looking across multiple customers and you're looking at what the prompts are, there'll be a lot of customers saying, well, hang on, I might be asking for something very specific, something sensitive to my business. How do you anonymize those prompts in such a way as to get that trend data?
We filter out all PII before we even capture the conversations, because truly what we're looking at is the trends of the type of questions being asked, any sort of like proper noun, things like that. It's all getting removed. And that's actually pretty similar to how our traditional product analytics would work, where we were never capturing form fields or data being entered onto the page. It doesn't matter whether you're putting Tom or Todd or whatever it is into a field. We kept using a field called name, and you're getting stuck trying to figure it out. I think similar with agency, we're stripping all that out. And it's interesting, we're able to do a pretty good job of surfacing the themes just by analyzing the conversations. That's actually one of the areas that LLMs are pretty good at. But we have some own algorithms for kind of how granular we can make those themes, because there is some sensitivity of, do you want very abstract themes or do you want more specific themes? For example, I could have a theme around customer health. People are asking about customer health, but then you could have a very specific one. I want action plans for how to improve a customer's health versus I just want essentially analytics. Very different use cases in my mind. We also work a lot with customers. At what level of granularity do you care about that you can then take action on your product teams?
How does this impact the UI? I've worked from old tech systems right the way through up to systems today that are moving towards more conversational engagement rather than menus or things that I do. Some have worked well, some haven't worked well, some things have almost disappeared from how a UI works. But however you design a UI, it has to work for a very wide group of people, not just those who want to use a conversational input.
Correct.
There'll be those, like me, who still like to go to a command line to do stuff with certain types of software. How difficult is it to meet the requirements of a large user base, and where in the UI do you start to say, this is our identity as the developer, and this is how we match our identity with customer need?
You got touched on it earlier in the conversation that the software development lifecycle is fundamentally changing. And we've seen this change. You and I have been in the industry for a very long period of time. When we started in the industry, it was kind of hard to build software. Even with RAD and other technologies, it was relatively challenging, especially to develop the software at scale. Through agile methodologies, cloud technologies, commodity hosting, you can put a button and have something in the cloud pretty fast. Now with AI, you can generate that thing that's going on. All we've seen is it's gotten easier and easier and easier and easier to build things. So you ask this question, how hard is it to maintain three different types of experiences? I think it's a hell of a lot easier now than it ever has been before. I think it's only going to get easier. To me, this comes down to just having really good architecture and how you build systems. It starts with a good API layer. And from that good API layer, what is that model? What is it going to expose? You can have a command line. interface, or headless, as people are talking about now. You can have a more conversational, maybe that API is wrapped in MCP tooling, which then, of course, these agents can use. And then you can also, from this API, have a very simple front end. Claude generates front ends that are pretty good, or lovable, or things like that. That's where the world's moving. The durable, great software companies are going to be really strong platforms that are systems of record, that have core business information that you're just not going to replicate in 20 different places. And then how you consume it is going to adapt. We build analytics products, and we talk a lot internally, what's the future of a dashboard? I could create a dashboard with 100 bells and whistles, a million little widgets, but at the end of the day, a lot of these things want to be tailored to the company that I don't even know what they want to look like. They want to match the other things inside their business. So do I care that they're maybe generating a dashboard with MCP tooling? I mean, it's our data. No, I don't care. And why? Maybe I shouldn't build dashboards anymore. Maybe I should just be in the business of exposing our data in a way that you can build your own custom dashboard, because you can generate one pretty quickly. That's the exciting thing. The future of user experience, I think we're going to see to be far more personalized than we ever have before. We've talked about the personalization of software, but now we can actually achieve it because these code generators are just so darn good.
But how do we get to that personalization? As you say, we've talked about it. We've allowed people to pull widgets onto screens, build their screen as they want. But if you're running a call center, if you're running a customer support function, your challenge is, what is the core data the operator absolutely must have? And then what does that operator maybe want to have on the screen that keeps the screen usable, not so cluttered, that quite frankly it ends up like a Formula One steering wheel?
Here's the interesting thing. How many humans are going to have in call centers anymore? And is it going to be mostly driven by AI, period? Like, if you do first line support via an agent, it's going to be really, really, really good. Much better than you had before. So I think this problem, you could argue, maybe from a meta level, is reducing over time. But I still think those interfaces are going to be very tightly designed. And they're going to be all around efficiency, reducing clicks. And there's a reason why airlines, you walk into an airport, you're going to see dumb terminals. Why? Because keyboard access is incredibly important. Tabs are incredibly important. You don't want to retrain people 100 different times on what the interface. We're still going to have like very, very tight interfaces. But there is an opportunity to adapt. We're working with a very large restaurant chain in the U.S. and they're taking their dumb terminal point of sale and they're modernizing it. They're using a lot of analytics to decide what goes on that screen and what actually gets clicked a lot and what doesn't get clicked a lot. And they're starting to make really smart product decisions around only surfacing the things that are really, really high volume clicks. So if you have a more advanced use case, I mean, like take catering. Some people come in and do a catering order. It is not the average order. So how do we create an interface that is far more personalized based on real world usage? But here's the cool thing. Some restaurants, some franchises may have more catering orders than others, and they may have terminals within it that are 100% focused on catering. Like, so how do we make sure the software knows that the requirements out of that particular terminal is different, and we maybe present a different UI? That's where, again, having data allows you to make these informed decisions.
So we've mentioned AI a few times in here. If we look across the product lifecycle, we have initial idea, first thoughts, first play, how do we do some design, put some bits and pieces together for samples, get to code. You talked earlier about being able to fail, change, move things around. People don't necessarily like that. They prefer stability on an enterprise level, but I understand where you're going with that. And then we get to the point where what becomes the next version? Where should we go? What can we produce alongside this? And how do we sunset this and make this work? Where for you is the sweet spot of AI at this moment in time? And how does it work across the whole life cycle, or are there sections that will stay human only?
That's a good question. A human is still accountable to the result. And a human is still involved in the overall design. I always tell people when you're looking at AI, the question is what goes in the prompt? Someone has to put something in the prompt. Or maybe you're pulling from a ticket. The ticket is the prompt. But you have to direct the AI. A human is often doing the directing. And if you have sets of agents working for you, there's still intent in mind. Here's the thing that I'm interested in. What is the architecture for this application? What are the things that you care about from a scale perspective? Where are you taking this in the future? How do you want to adapt it going forward? Someone is still an architect, and a human is still involved in that. From an experience perspective, and people are using this word all the time. I've talked to different people in the last few weeks, and some people like it, some people don't. But taste. Taste really matters. Taste is how someone experiences the application. There's famous tastemakers like Steve Jobs who hated keyboards, so he excluded the keyboard. Now we all have touchscreens. Great products are designed by tastemakers that have like a specific look and feel. People like them. And I still think tastemaking is going to exist. There's no way that every app is going to look exactly the same because Claude just decides to make it look that way. That is not the future.
It's identity and brand, though, isn't it?
There's no differentiation in it. And good products are differentiated. The winning products are differentiated. So the only way you get differentiation is to have some level of taste and uniqueness. It's got to look different, feel different.
Do you think the software industry gets that? Because if you look at the clothing industry, they get that this is still functionally a pair of jeans. But actually the branding on those jeans and just a little bit of styling, Levi's 501's an absolutely classic story here. Software companies, in my experience, seem to be less rigid in creating a brand and a feel.
Oh, I think that's coming back. I agree with you. Not enough software companies are focused on creating a great brand. But if you look at some of these new companies, there's a reason why Legora has Jude Law on billboards all over London. So Law never looks so good. I mean, it says something. It says something to me. They're not trying to be Harvey. And Harvey's like a different style. I mean, even the name Harvey like connotes something from a branding perspective. I think that's interesting. I mean, Anthropic, from the colors they use in the brand, soft tones, to the we care about safety and blah, blah, blah. It says something. If you're thinking about OpenAI versus Anthropic, you feel like the Anthropic people care more about safety than the OpenAI people. You feel like they're just out to make a buck. Very intentional brand building. I do think we're starting to see the reemergence of brand. In a world where you can generate anything, how do you pick what thing you want? It's going to be some connection to a brand. Yesterday, there was a lot of news around the company Finn, an Irish company, got bought by Salesforce. Boy, they have a brand. A strong Irish Finn that obviously connects back to Irish folklore. They've had this Phoenix Rising story around we were a SaaS company and now we're an AI company, and that is their brand, and they are the best at it. They have been loud about it, and they've owned their narrative in a way that's been very, very impressive. You could argue it's contributed to their success. This is my prediction. The great companies going forward in software will have great brands, and the ones that don't invest in it will fail.
But brand creation, brand identity has always been a soft skill. As you say, it's about taste. AI is now absolutely being dropped into that space. I look at Adobe, I look at three or four other companies. At what point does that give us greater capability to experience new things, experiment with other options, look at where the brand is strong, what's going on, come back to your point about analytics, and where does it potentially end up as a distraction?
Well, again, it comes down to like what you put in the prompt. If you say, come up with a brand that's edgy for my company, you're going to have a bunch of slop coming out. If you say very specifically what you want and what you're going for and describe it with a lot of detail, you're now going to have the ability to iterate and experiment like you've never had before. And that's where things get exciting to me, is the iteration and the experimentation. But it takes someone with taste. One of my classic examples I always like to give, and because I had her on stage with me in an interview, is this, the founder of the Milk Bar. Milk Bar makes cakes for those who in the U.S. I think they have them here probably. But anyway, she was the first person to ever not frost, really famously not frost this edges of a cake. Now, if you search on AI, like generate an image of a cake, most of them have frosting around the edges. But because of her, she was the first person not to do it. Now you probably will see a few cakes without it. But someone had to ask the question, show me this, but do it differently. This is the differentiation I want. This is my signature decision. We're going to need more. People are going to have to take some risks and do something that never been done before. Because AI has been trained on things that have been done before. By definition, it's not trained on things that didn't exist because they have not existed yet. So I think that's the exciting part for me, is how do we start taking some risks and doing things that haven't been done before?
The danger is all we end up is with derivative solutions.
Exactly. But we know that those will fail ultimately because it has become commodities, and then commodities go to lowest cost solutions, then whoever can do it cheapest ultimately is the winner in those markets. That's not how you win. If you look at the commodity software markets, operating systems, those are OEM businesses that are just now included in technology. The interesting thing is we don't have a ton of commodities, not successful commodity software companies historically.
Our core element is code. And we write code, we struggle with code, AI's come along to give us code. Yes, it will give me code that compiles, doesn't mean it's secure code. How do we make it easier for everybody in the product cycle, in a controlled manner, to be able to say, this is a possible feature, this is something useful, and then use the AI tools to help generate code for that experimentation in such a way that we can then upgrade that into a product plan?
I think we're starting to see this now. We can now prototype in ways that you used to be able to come up with an idea that could be a feature, and you'd write a product requirements document, or you'd create a number of tickets. Then you'd have to wait. You'd be waiting for some engineer to pull a spike, or maybe you'd be waiting for a designer to do a Figma. When Figma came out, then you started very quickly taking Figma designs to customers and started validating it. But those are usually like mildly interactive. They're not super interactive. So you're getting only so much signal on it. Now people are giving them full-on working prototypes. I have our chief product officer, who's not the most technical person, just creating whole mock-ups, showing customers, and handing it to teams, and saying, look, customer like this. What do you say? Now, I don't know if it's always the most scalable way to build software, but that's exciting. It's exciting to get things in front of real people and see how they experiment with it and say, okay, now let's actually build this thing for real that scales and is on our platform and things like that. So I think the prototyping solutions are how you get there.
But that's interesting, because that goes back to what you were talking earlier about personalization. When we write software, we tend to think of software as a complete solution. Front end, back end, all the gubbins in between. Cloud's brought us platforms.
Yeah.
Composable architectures have taken us back to that object orientation conversation from the late 1980s. Does AI, from your personalization perspective, finally put us in the point where your COO can sit in front of a customer and who says, I like that feature, and you deliver that to their team as a box of widgets that they then compose themselves? Is that the big shift in software?
I absolutely think we're going to get there. And that's also why you're seeing the rise of these new hot roles in software and tech, is this forward deployed engineer. If you're sending an actual engineer on site to the customer with these Legos, they're putting it together for you and then leaving you with a bespoke solution that is meant for your business, but built on our platform. So we still have the platform. We maintain the platform. That's the hard bits, like how you present it, the UI. We're now seeing that to be the easy part of the problem. We've always known it's an easier part of the problem, but now it's really easy. That's the exciting part.
Well, one of the benefits of a platform is that we are able to evolve that as we want, take the customer on that journey to the next version, limit the number of back versions, but customers also want their own code in there. They want their own bits. How do you, in a composable world, make the platform in such a way that the customer can build their own widgets, drop them in, and those widgets survive from version to version to version of the underlying platform? Because that's a hell of an engineering challenge.
Yeah, the key thing, in at least today's technology, we're starting to see these composable applications that are based on these disparate MCP tooling. So if I have a set of tools from vendor A and a set of tools from vendor B, then I have some internal tools that we've built that are, you know, very specific and tailored to my business. I can compose an application using all three that has reasoning across all three. And that's a pretty interesting solution. Now, all three of those tool sets are probably going to get upgraded. They're probably going to change. The models are changing. So you need to keep an eye on all these different things. I think we're seeing a level of interoperability now that's pretty powerful.
Where does Leo sit in that? Because if you've got a customer who's got custom components, they're sitting on your platform, you evolve the platform.
Yeah.
Now, you might break some of the things the customer was relying on, or deprecate them, or move them. Does Leo now become that frontline integration assistant? So when the client says, yes, I'm looking to move to Pendo 26.6, but I've got all these things I built on 18.2, what do I need to do? Is that a place that Leo could sit?
The value of Leo is to abstract the complexity of the platform away from the customer and just answer their questions 100%. The thing that I've been excited about the way we've designed Leo is that we developed it with a preset skills that we know that Leo should be good at. You can ask Leo still anything you want, and it does a pretty good job of answering it. But we're saying if you want to go deep on certain areas in our platform, you can run a skill and it'll do so. Where I see it going in the future, and where we like to go with it, is have skills to be customer dependent. I would love for customers to be able to upload their own skills. Maybe even have a marketplace of skills. share skills across customers as well. It's very possible if you're a bank, you're going to have skills that are very specific to your applications that you want Leo to know about, that you want to share across all of your team members. For me, Leo should become more of the front door. With Leo, we obviously personified it, but we want it to be a virtual human that's helping you around Pendo. And yes, absolutely abstracting away from this version change to this, or even you're going from this. The one thing that Leo's done, which I think is exciting, is when we build these software applications, we have multiple products. Everything was designed on these tabbed architecture. I have tab A, I've got tab B. Leo breakdowns all the tabs. There's no tabs. And Leo's access to all the data in this platform, you don't have to toggle here, or toggle there, or go from product A to product B. It actually breakdowns the walls. And it's really focusing on solving use cases. And that's how software is meant to be consumed. It's all about solving a use case. And I think that's where we're going in this industry. That's what gets me excited about Leo.
We're short on time, so I'm going to ask you one last question. Where is the industry going? If you were sitting in front of a group of customers out there, or potential customers, who've got software solutions, but they don't know where they're going to need to evolve their methods, their processes, the software lifecycle, what would you tell them to start to be ready for, and what would you tell them to expect to be the future way software will evolve?
What we're seeing is just an incredible acceleration of speed and the cost and effort to build something. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to become zero, but it's like nearing towards almost like an asymptotic like line, like right above zero. Okay, so what does that mean? So I would assume that models are going to continue to get smarter. You're going to see diminishing quality at some time. The future is, okay, now that I can create anything, what is the most important thing to create? How do I not just add so that I end up with slop everywhere? You don't want an infinite software. You want finite software. So we talked about how do we encourage people to measure and only have the technology that's truly relevant and truly serving their business. That's going to be a good piece of it. I think the other thing that we're going to start seeing that's adding as a constraint is cost and performance are going to become more important constraints. And everyone now has just been like paying more and more for tokens, but you're starting to see a lot of press around token maxing and token usage and costs going up. There's going to be just an incredible growth and diversity of models. And right now you have a handful of frontier models, but you're going to have purpose-built models, custom-trained models, open-source models, different models for different tasks. I mean, you're not just going to keep adding to your budget. So the future is going to be certain models for certain tasks and making sure that the software we're not just adding all the time, but we're removing, curating, and then hopefully personalized experiences so we're not overwhelmed by technology. Because I think there's a good chance we could become overwhelmed.
Oh, very easily. Todd, thank you for talking with me.
Yeah, my pleasure.